Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 24th, 2015, and this is show number 524. Well, today we passed the 500 mark in our Google Plus community over at podfeet.com/Google Plus. I was just happened to be dinking around and I noticed it said 499. So I did a tweet and I said, hey, somebody push us over 500. Well, a couple people did it right away. The only one I've been able to figure out exactly who joined was Gary Benny. Welcome aboard. Gary Benny is our 500th Google Plus community member. We have a lot of fun over there. Go on over and check it out. A lot of good people helping each other. And I think that's really, really fun over there. And I use it a lot as a great resource to get help for me. So go check it out. My daughter was nicknamed Ghiblies by her roommates in college because she has shaky hands. Most of the time, her Ghiblies aren't a problem, but a few weeks ago, she wanted to take a picture and asked her darling husband for his iPhone, which she promptly dropped and shattered the screen. Well, 2 days later, she dropped her own iPhone, shattering that screen too. The good news for Lindsay was that when I bought it for her for Christmas, I bought it with AppleCare. I am a huge proponent of AppleCare, especially for things that we can carry around. The iPhone deal in the U.S. at least, is that it extends your hardware warranty from 1 year to 2 years and phone support from 90 days to 2 years. But it also gives you two repairs for any kind of accidental damage. You do have to pay $79 for each repair, but it's cheaper than the $109 Apple charges to replace the screen. You also get the refurb on the spot instead of waiting for days for a repair, and it protects you from other kinds of accidental damage like that pesky water electronics seem to seek. Unfortunately for her husband, Nolan's iPhone was out of AppleCare because it was over 2 years old. The good news is that he went ahead and finally upgraded to an iPhone 6 Plus, and now he's really happy that Ghiblies gave him an excuse to get a new iPhone. Well, right around that time, Honda Bob, my longtime mechanic and friend and NoCilla castaway, called me up to tell me that he dropped his phone and cracked the screen. Being a mechanic, he wanted to fix it himself, but he didn't have the tiny pentalobe screwdriver or the teeny tiny suction cup to pull off the screen. I proudly announced that I have the handy dandy 70-piece toolkit from iFixit, so I could actually loan him a tool for once. How fun is that? Anyway, then I got a great idea. I thought maybe we could have a play date and replace the screens on both iPhones together. We went out independently to look for screens. He found one through Amazon that was $35 before tax and shipping for the full screen assembly. That includes the screen, but also the camera and home button. Now, I've always been a fan of iFixit, and especially for all the free instructions you can get over there. So I thought I should throw them some business and buy my screen assembly through them. However, the price there was $65 before tip and tax. I wrote a question in the iFixit forums there asking, is it worth the price premium? You know, I mean, that's almost double. I explained that I was probably going to go ahead and do it anyway, out of loyalty alone, but I was hoping for more justification from someone, hopefully iFixit themselves. Well, iFixit did get back to me, and they explained that they test the components themselves, and the parts come with a 1 year warranty, so they stand behind those parts. Good enough for me. I went ahead and bought the iPhone 5 display assembly kit from iFixit. Well, Honda Bob came over and we got to work. Even though we set up on our kitchen table where Steve has put in a lamp so bright white that people tell us we could probably do surgery in there, we quickly realized we needed more light. I went and got the standing LED magnifying lamp my friend Diane convinced me to buy for my cross-stitch work, and then we were in business. I'm sure Michelle will like that I'm reusing a cross-stitch lamp for tech. How fun is that? Anyway, the first step is to take out two itty-bitty tiny itsy-bitsy pentalobe screws. That was really easy. The second step, though, is to pull the screen off using that little suction cup that comes in the iFixit toolkit. Funny story, when I first got the iFixit toolkit, I didn't know what that little suction cup was for because I knew about the two big ones that you use on pulling off an iMac monitor. And when I got that kit, I was like, what is this little one for? But when Honda Bob said he needed a little tiny suction cup, that's when I figured it out. Anyway, pulling that off with a suction cup sounds easy too, but it was the hardest part of the process for me. You have to hold onto the edges of the phone without touching the glass and then pull as hard as you can at an angle with a suction cup. I'm embarrassed to admit that I actually had to have Bob do the first one because I could not pull it off. Now, Nolan's phone was a little bit trickier because most of the screen was shattered, so a suction cup wouldn't stick to it. Honda Bob's was just kind of the corner. iFixit suggested covering it with strapping tape. They also said it's a good idea so you don't get shards of glass all over the place when you do chip it out of there. Well, having seen Bob succeed pulling his off, I was bound and determined to pull Nolan's green off myself, and I was in the end successful. It was still really hard. Once we were inside, it was actually a cakewalk to pull this thing apart. We had to remove three microscopic screws that held down a very small metal bracket, then pop off three connectors. I'm not actually being sarcastic. I know it's hard to tell with me sometimes. It really was that easy. I figured going into this that I would be helping Honda Bob. Not because I had better mechanical chops, that's for sure, but because he's got these giant-sized hands made for car-sized parts, not miniature iPhone-sized parts. As embarrassed as I was to admit that I needed his help pulling the screen off, I'm even more embarrassed to admit that I needed his help feeding the teeny-tiny little connectors back into place to put it back together. Two of the three cables were relatively easy to align back on their wee tiny connectors, but the third one, it seemed like it was actually too long to bend into position to meet the connector. Bob and I took turns, and Bob in the end was able to get the first one in place, and again, after watching him work, I knew it was possible, so I was bound and determined to get the second one in place on myself, and I did succeed with that. By the way, to show you what I mean about his giant hands, we took a photo of him putting in one of the tiniest little screws back in place, and that, of course, is in the show notes, along with some other photos. He really surprised me with the dexterity with those man paws of his. We were almost 100% successful with our repairs. With Bob's phone, when we tried to press the glass back in place, we pressed on either side of the home button, and a tiny crack developed in that narrowest part of the glass. He was going to put a glass screen protector on anyway, and it's barely visible, so he wasn't too distressed by it. I'm not sure if it's how we put the glass on, or by any chance the fault of the component itself. I don't know. I don't know where these parts come from, I can't say. We were very cautious on the second one to press on the button area itself on Nolan's phone, and it went back into place perfectly. I can highly recommend doing this yourself if you have the nerve, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. At NAB, one of the great joys was getting to hang out with the wonderful folks from Boink Software. Bastian Wolf is one of the funniest people I know. CEO Oliver Breidenbach is so much fun to tease. And it was really great fun to meet his brother, Akeem Breidenbach, who works there too, for the first time. We'd never met him before. We had breakfast with them in L.A. before NAB. We had breakfast with them again in Las Vegas. And we harassed him a lot at their booth at NAB. We figured the least we could do was an interview on the show floor. Here's Bastian Wolf telling me about the new Boinks TV 2. I'm in the Boinks booth with Bastian Wolf, and I never know what's going to happen when I talk to Bastian. I'm a little afraid.
Neither do I, to be honest.
He said he was going to talk about the taco you had for lunch, but I'd really like to hear more about Boinks TV.
Okay, yeah, well, it's your choice.
We could go that way.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, we're coming up with Boinks TV 2, which is one version further than Boinks TV 1, of course, and it's going to change a lot. You don't like my glasses?
I can't see a darn thing with your glasses on. Let me put mine back on.
Okay.
Okay.
So,
From the top, assume people have never heard of Boinks TV.
Okay, Boinks TV is a video production, live video production software. It does camera switching, it does chroma keying, titling, lower thirds, whatever you want to do. And when it comes to live video production, it probably does it. And so think about doing, I don't know, a conference, doing a webcast, doing a news show, or doing, you might have heard of this thing called podcasts. You're doing a video podcast, for example. You would want to use something like Boinks TV, or you would only want to use Boinks TV. Let's put it that way.
Not something like Boinks,
yeah,
Boinks TV.
I mean, it's like the best of the best. And you can create all the graphics, all the titles, all the camera switches while you are recording this. That means the second you're done recording, you're done with the post-production, because you did the post-production as a live production while you were shooting it. That, you know, that takes the time you would need for post-producing it. Well,
nobody likes post-production.
Yeah, I mean, many people get paid for it, but
but they still don't like it.
Yeah, that's probably the case. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All right. So this is we're looking at. So this is audio and video. So we're looking at our friend Akeem, mm-hmm. wearing a green shirt in front of a green screen. And, well, what else we see in here?
Yeah, so right now he's chroma keyed, so as good as is possible.
And for the audience, chroma key means?
Removing the background, in that case a green background, from the image and replacing it with something completely different. So as you can see, for example, we have this spinning globe that is behind him, and we can turn it off and on. We have a background, a greenish background that we can switch on and off. You could also put in an image there, a photo or a fake 3D studio. You could put it... behind
it. I love that look when people do that. I think it's cool.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, we do chroma keying, but you can just connect cameras and switch between different cameras. So we have different cameras set up
where,
here.
Where was that camera from?
Yeah, it's the hidden camera. This one.
It's really freaking me out.
There.
Oh, okay, there it is.
Yeah. So what we're showing here is
we're mixing
and matching. That's the word, camera. So we have the big Blackmagic camera over there, but then we're mixing them with the Logitech C930 and C920 cameras, which are USB cameras. So the Blackmagic camera comes in over SDI using a Blackmagic mini recorder, and those cameras are connected directly to the Mac without any further hardware. The other thing we can also do is we can connect an iPad just via USB to the computer and get the iPad screen. So you could, of course, play games, which who doesn't love playing games, but you could also like run your PowerPoint off that and do your
keynote.
I'm sorry, yeah. Oh, God, I'm such
or a demo that you're doing.
Yeah, for example. And You can do your presentation or your webcast right from there. And since we're talking about webcasts, Boinks TV 2 is going to have built-in streaming. So you basically, for example, choose, I want to stream to YouTube, and then you do your live stream right to YouTube.
So will it work with a Google Plus Hangout then?
No, it's going to be a direct stream. So you just put in your YouTube credentials, and it will. YouTube also does streaming without Hangouts, which
they do.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's pretty hidden in their user interface, but they luckily they have an API, so we can take care of that to set it up. And if you don't like YouTube, you can use Ustream or any other streaming provider that does the standard streaming stuff. What they all do.
Yeah, I had to leave. Justin threw us out right when they went all gaming, and Ustream got a little. The ads were getting pretty annoying, and so I went over to Google Plus for my live show right now, but I don't do it. But that records me to YouTube, but it doesn't make a live YouTube.
Well, yeah, you can do that over a Hangout in Air.
Right, that's what I'm doing.
But the setup for me is kind of weird. And like this, you will only have to log into YouTube, and it does the magic behind the scenes. And you have a live stream, and you can still record at the same time to your disk. So if you want to edit something out later on, because sometimes stuff happens, you know.
I never make any mistakes when I'm recording.
Yeah, well, but
other people.
You're not all as perfect as you are.
Exactly, exactly. So there's a bunch of controls across the bottom here, too. What is all that?
So down there, we have the layers that ship with Boinks TV. Boinks TV is layer-based, as in Photoshop, for example. So if you put something on top of the other thing, it's going to be in front of it and the other way around. I can show you, for example, with a spinning globe behind Achim. So if I take the globe and place it on top of the video that displays Achim, let's make that a little bit easier to see. Now it's in front of him. If I drag it right below him, it's behind him. So,
Wow. And that's all doing that real time.
Yeah, it's doing that real time in 1080p and I think 60 frames a second. So that's pretty cool. And so the things at the very bottom are the layers that come with Boinks TV. So it does a lot like really cheesy stuff.
But you got like templates I can see. Like you've got date and time and channel logo, station logo, Google Maps.
So there's a lot you might need for your show. Maybe you need a NozillaCast station logo there. So you just import a graphic and put the station logo layer there, and you basically have your station logo as they have on a TV show.
And is this something someone else controls while you're the on-air talent, right?
It depends. If you're crazy like I am a little bit, then you control it while you're on the air. By, for example, using an iPad. If you show the app again, the control app, yeah. You could use a third party app and then, for example, shoot lower thirds just by tapping a button, and that does it from the iPad. So you could, in theory, do that while in front of the camera. I would suggest though, because that's the way you don't get crazy. You have someone doing that while you were. Yeah,
well, I'm actually looking to offload some work to Steve.
That's good,
so right now I end up doing it all myself while I'm trying to record the show, and I'm creating a show while I'm doing all the work. So this is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I like it. I use it for my own podcast, and for me it works like a charm.
Yeah, it looks really cool. So Boinks TV 2 is coming out when?
When it's done. there's going to be a public beta right after NAB. So I can
break everything.
That's pretty good. We need people like that to make sure it doesn't break in the future. So I hope you will not break it in the future. And we're talking about mid this year when we're going to release Bunks TV 2, unless something, so you break it too bad. I don't know.
Or in case it's just perfect when I test it.
Yeah, that's probably the case.
Oh, there you go. So what's the price point of Bunks TV?
We haven't decided yet on a specific price point, but it's going to be in the realms of Bunks TV 1. Bunks TV 1 was $4.99 for the full version, and that's probably going to be the same with Bunks TV 2. We're planning on doing a subscription model as well. So if you say, I just need it, I don't know, 3 months a year, you just rent it for 3 months, and that's pretty much it.
That's an interesting way to go, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, very, very good luck to you. And how do people find Bunks TV 2?
They just go to boinks.com and they will find every bit of information they will need to know about it.
All right, and how about your podcast? Plug your podcast.
Well, it's German, so if you're speaking German...
German. Well, I know another German guy. We know Klaus. Remember, we talked about him.
Yeah, right. You're right. So if Klaus is watching, he can go to digitalupgrade.de, and this is where we do the stuff no one does with Boinks TV because it tends to break stuff. So it's a little bit, it's a different, we do actual real 3D studios with our German podcast, and it's a lot of fun.
All right, sounds like fun. Talk to you later, Bastian.
Thank you, bye-bye.
I can't wait until Bunks TV 2 comes out. That sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun to play with. One of my favorite things about doing the NoCellacast is the emails I get from people when they send in their first audio review for the show. They usually go something like this. Wow, that was really hard. I had to re-record 28 times. It took me forever to do a 3-minute review. How do you do it every week? Anyway, I love it because these people come away appreciating the sport that is podcasting. Of course, after they do a few, they get the hang of it and they aren't so amazed anymore, but at least it's fun for a while. Well, I bring this up because I've experienced the same thing on the flip side doing videos for Don McAllister's Screencasts Online. You cannot believe how hard it is to do what he does. I'm only doing a tutorial every couple of months, and it's positively exhausting. Here's the typical process I go through. First, spend a week or so perusing my applications folder to find a suitable application to record. Realize that the app you've chosen is either too esoteric and not enough people would get something out of it, or it's too simple so it won't fill a 30-minute show. Go back, peruse applications some more, and find a good app to record. Next, I like to storyboard out what I'm going to say. I like to use iThoughts 10, the one with an X, anyway, to do a mind map because it lets me throw out a jumble of stuff I want to say and later organize it by dragging the bubbles around until I get a cohesive story. All right, now I got to go research the vendor's website to find out their pricing model. Do they have a free trial? And I like to read their documentation to make sure I know how to use the tool well. I often know a tool for what I use it for, but it often has more capabilities that I don't know about, and I need to be thorough. Now it's time to practice. Even on tools I know really well, I have to practice so I can demonstrate and talk at the same time. It's trickier than you would think. I need to be able to explain why I'm doing something, not just click buttons. By now, you'll notice that I haven't even launched ScreenFlow, the fabulous screencasting software from Telestream that we use to do these videos. My user account has all kinds of crazy hoopla going on in it. I've got weird extensions, it makes strange noises, and it's got a goofy background. I created a second user account called Screencast Online so it would match what Don's looks like. You know, you got to have some consistency there. I downloaded his official Screencast Online desktop background. I set the screen resolution for recording. It's really important to get the best resolution, so Don likes it at 1280 by 720 with high DPI. In order to talk a Mac into doing that resolution, you need to install a system preference pane called Switch Res X from madrow.com. Note that even if I've been in the account like an hour ago, when I log back in, the screen resolution will have reset itself. So I have to fix this every single time. The downside of this is that now your computer monitor looks like a Fisher-Price toy because the resolution is so low. When you're doing a screen recording, it's really annoying if you ask an application to open a window and it opens on your second monitor. You have to open up the Display Preferences pane, click on Arrange, and then drag the little white menu bar over to your recording monitor to make sure it's the main monitor. This one always flips back on its own, so I have to check it every single time. Now I close the window so the audio doesn't record the birds outside or the weed whacker the neighbor just decided to use. I unplug the phone, turn down the intercom in case somebody rings the doorbell, take the collar off the dog so she doesn't make noises when she walks around or does that shake thing that dogs like to do. All right, we're almost ready. I should probably go downstairs to get a snack first, right? Maybe some water. Oh man, the laundry needs to be folded. I better get that done first. All right, back upstairs. Got to focus. Got to start. Oh, shoot. I forgot. There's a file I need back over on my normal user account. Hey, look, someone's wrong on Twitter. Better fix that. Ooh, that article looks interesting. I might need to put that on Google+. Darn. Well, it's dinner time. I can start in this tomorrow. You'll notice that I'm going to have to go back and start all that stuff back over on that account when I get back to it tomorrow. At some point, I actually start, but it can take me days to start. I don't know why, but starting is really hard for me. This week, I finally got started recording 2 days before the video was due back to Don. Remember, I had like 60 days to prepare for this. I'm like that kid who wakes up 2 days before the science fair and realizes, oh no, is that today? I had 9 months to prepare and I have done nothing. Well, this week was super entertaining because I had recorded the intro where I explained the problem to be solved. I showed the download, I installed the software, and I started to do the first part of the demo, and then the software started failing. I'm not going to tell you what the software was because it's wonderful software from a very responsive vendor who's trying really hard to diagnose why it's failing on me. We just can't figure it out. It has not failed in probably 7 years of me using it, but for the life of me, it would not work properly when I was trying to record it. That meant in 1 day, I had to find another app, research it, storyboard it, practice it, and make the recording. Now, I'm not telling you this story to make you feel sorry for me. I'm telling you because when I told Don this, all he said was, yeah, don't you hate when that happens? No surprise at all, because he'd lived through that same kind of thing so many times. Another time, I'd actually got prepared well ahead of time, started recording a full week in advance of the due date, only to have the vendor come out with a new version at the end of the week. Again, Don said, yeah, don't you hate when that happens? I've always said that Don's magic is that he's so skilled at learning and explaining software, but after screencasting a mile in his shoes, I think it said he doesn't lose his ever-loving mind doing this job. If you've ever experienced any repetitive stress from using a traditional mouse, or if you hope to avoid it ever happening to you, you might want to consider the Contour Roller Mouse Red. It's a very unusual pointy device. It's not a roller ball. It's not a trackpad. It's not a mouse. Let's hear from the interview at NAB with Contour, where you're going to hear what it actually is. I'm in the Contour booth with Andrew Morgan, and he was using something really strange looking with his keyboard, and I couldn't figure out what it was, so we decided to ask him about it. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm good, yeah. So this is the Roller Mouse Red Plus, and it's an ergonomic solution to the average mousing, and it provides a much more comfortable feel to mousing, removing that whole clawed hand that you get, and reducing the pain in your wrists or in your shoulders by just giving you a very nice squared up position against your keyboard.
So this is audio as well as video. So for the people who can't see what we're looking at, describe what you're showing to us. Because this is not a mouse. This is not a trackpad. This is not a rollerball. Well, what is this?
So, it is a mouse, but it's a roller bar. So the idea is that it has a large wrist rest with a small button section, as well as a roller bar with a tube on it.
So it's a cylinder, the length of the keyboard, with a roller thing on it.
Yes, and actually with our design, there's a sensor inside the tube which reads the movement of the bar as it goes back and forth and rolls forward and backward, which allows for that nice smooth rolling feel.
It really looks fun to use.
It is, and I mean, it does take a short time to get used to it for the average person who's used to using a normal mouse up and down and all over, but once people get used to it and have tried it for about a week, it really does improve their quality of mousing incredibly.
It's amazing how quickly some of that pain goes away. I mean, if you've done permanent nerve damage, no. Right. But a lot of us get to the point where we find another solution early, as I did, and all of a sudden you're not in pain anymore. So that's a great thing.
Yes, absolutely.
So you mentioned that there's some control keys not quite on center in this case. It looks like it's slightly off center. So what is that?
Yes. So with our roller mouse, we put the button section actually in line to be more directly underneath your main typing section. Normally, we like to keep it aligned with the B key on a typical keyboard.
Okay, what he's got here is an extended keyboard, so that's why it's off to one side.
Right, exactly. But along with, you know, its position, we have these multiple keys. And within our Contour driver, all of these keys can be customized along with having their set functions. So out of the box, it'll give you your left click, your right click, a double click, and a copy and paste up top. plus a scroll wheel and an additional button which helps you change the sensitivity of your roller bar.
Okay.
And then within the Contour driver, you can set these keys to be any additional functions you like. So I know personally, I like to have an undo and a redo up top as well.
Oh, make a lot of mistakes, do you?
Yes, all the time.
I never do. This is pretty cool. So this is the product, Deanna, is called?
The Roller Mouse Red Plus.
And how much does that cost?
I believe it's, actually, what is it?
Tyler. We'll take a short intermission while he finds out how much the roller...
The Roller Mouse Red Plus is going for $265 right now.
All right, and now this has a pretty substantial wrist rest area. You've got another one that we're there's other people looking at right now as a smaller wrist rest. What is that one called?
So that is the Roller Mouse Red, and it's essentially the same product, just with it's got the standard wrist rest. This one is the next one up, which gives you the extended wrist rest.
Okay, and how much is that product?
Same cost. So so you can purchase, you could purchase that one, and then as well you could purchase an extended wrist rest separately if you wanted to.
Oh, I see how it works. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, and how would people find out more about these products?
You can find out more about our products at contourdesign.com.
All right, that sounds really good. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Great, thank you very much.
Apple has brought out several new products lately that are making it hard to choose a laptop. It's easy to tell people what to buy based on your own needs, but that doesn't mean your answer would be right for them. Now that Apple has a pretty deep bench of laptops, it's even harder to tell the right answer. Recently, my husband Steve, our friend Ron, and I all bought new laptops. In all cases, they were our second machines, so you would think maybe we would end up with the same machine, but we all bought three completely different models. That might got me thinking that a nice little Q&A might help people determine which model is right for them. So let's go through those. I want a Mac laptop. What should I get? Check out the 12-inch MacBook. Weighing in at an amazing 2 pounds, it has a gorgeous Retina screen and a battery that lasts all day. It's got that fancy Force Touch trackpad and the new Scissor Key keyboard. It even comes in 3 colors, silver, space gray, and gold. The 12-inch MacBook isn't powerful enough for me with that Core M processor. I know it's not powerful because I heard about one article that said it was the same speed as a 2011 MacBook Air. I like to think of myself as a power user. Of course, I haven't tested the new 12-inch MacBook with my applications, nor have I read any reviews since that article was first published. All right. Can I suggest the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro? You can max it out with the Intel i7 processor, 16 gigabytes of RAM, and a 1 terabyte SSD. It's a fabulous workhorse of a machine. It's recently been updated to include the Force Touch trackpad, so you'll have all the bells and whistles. Well, but the 15-inch MacBook Pro is too darn heavy at 4.46 pounds. All right, well, maybe the 13-inch MacBook Pro is right for you. It, too, can be maxed out to an Intel i7, 16 gigabytes of RAM, and a 1 terabyte SSD. Like the 15-inch model, the 13-inch has a Force Touch trackpad now, too. Well, but the 13-inch MacBook Pro is still too heavy at nearly 3.5 pounds. It's so thick and chunky at 0.71 inches thick. All right, I bet you'd enjoy the 13-inch MacBook Air, then. It's at least thinner on one edge than the 13-inch MacBook Pro. It weighs 15% less. It's just a smidgen under 3 pounds. It's got the power you seek because you can push the MacBook Air up to an Intel i7. But you will be capped at 8 gigabytes of RAM and a 512 gigabyte SSD. But that's still pretty amazing in that thin little laptop. This machine was recently upgraded to the newest Intel Broadwell chipset, which makes it faster while requiring less battery, so the power life is insane. But I want a Retina screen. All right, just go away and leave me alone now then. I'm a pretty big fan of gestures on the Mac. Not a crazy person about it, but there's a few on which I depend constantly. I can't stand hard clicking on a trackpad. It's a lot better on the Force Touch trackpad, by the way. It doesn't bother me as much, but in general, I don't like hard clicking. I love to use 3 fingers to drag a window around, too. One of the very first things I do when I'm on a new Mac is to enable tap to click and 3-finger drag. You find that in System Preferences, Trackpad, Point and Click. Imagine my dismay when I went to that preference pane on my new 12-inch MacBook, only to find that the 3-finger drag was gone. I went off to the Googles and buried in an Apple discussion forum. A person named Deep Rich explained that it's still there, but for some reason Apple decided to bury it in the accessibility preference pane. And by bury it, I mean 6 levels deep. I'm reasonably good at following text explanations, but I decided this was crying out for a clarified document. Using Clarify's built-in screenshot tool on my MacBook Pro, I showed where the three-finger drag used to be. So that's on my MacBook Pro because I was able to bring it up, right? I saved the document, the Clarify document, right into Evernote. That did the sync to the cloud dance in a couple of seconds. So I was able to open Evernote on my MacBook and pull up the same Clarify document. Then I took the rest of the screenshot showing how it's missing on the MacBook and then walking through the six levels of Inception to reveal the toggle for three-finger drag. I typed in explanations on each step, changed the titles of the steps to be clever and entertaining, and then I posted the document to tutorials over on podfeet.com. As always, this will be useful to others searching now, and it will definitely help me when I completely forget how to do this next time. If you need to, want to, or have to make instructions for yourself or others, check out a free trial of Clarify over clarify-it.com. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and I could not be happier to have Bart Bouchatz on the show this actual day. And why would that be, Bart?
That would be because Ireland has made some history today. And actually, my better half just reminded me that we had this vote on marriage equality on Harvey Milk Day.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I didn't realize yesterday that it was Harvey Milk Day, but just today, it was like, oh, hang on a second. Yesterday it was, and we voted yesterday, so... For those of you who haven't caught up with the news, although I think it's making the American media quite strongly.
Oh, it's huge, yeah.
So Ireland is now the 21st country in the world to have marriage equality, and we're the first of those 21 to do it by referendum. So in other words, we put it to a vote of the entire country, and the entire country went thumbs up. The final number isn't in, but it's looking to be about 60%, 40%.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's not a slim margin.
No, and what really surprises me, so there's a link in the show notes to the electoral map, and as we record, there's three constituencies out of 43 that haven't reported, so 40 out of 43 are in, and out of those, there are 39 yeses and one no. And, you know, the expectation was that the cities would be green and the rural areas would be red, and it's just not worked out like that. That stereotype just didn't hold, which
it's
is great.
Green, 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 green.
Green, yeah, apart from the one little bit...
That one that's no, it was, you said it was like 51-49, too.
It's 48.6 to 51.4.
Yeah, and so the other thing is the voter turnout was insane, right?
Right. The final number isn't in yet, but it's definitely in the 60s. And if it's not the highest in any referendum ever in Ireland, it's close. It's definitely the highest in the last few decades. These are turnouts like we'd be happy with on an election day for our government. And the only thing people went to vote on today was marriage referendum and whether or not we should lower the age for our president, which we didn't do.
And just to put that in perspective for the U.S. listeners, the highest number I could find in voter turnout for a presidential election was not as high as 60% in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years.
Mm. What really caught me actually was... In the weeks, as the time was closing for people to register to vote, there were queues of young people queuing up to register to vote. There were queues of young people voting. And what really made, like, if you really want your heartstrings tugged, check out the hashtag on Twitter, Home to Vote. In Ireland, you can't vote by postal ballot. So these are pictures of people on trains and planes, in groups with rainbow-coloured balloons, coming home from Australia, from Sweden, from the UK... Home to vote. It's really heartwarming stuff.
Wow. Very, very cool. Well, we are going to get into some tech stuff here, but this is that was just too exciting to not celebrate.
Well, I was going to say my brain is just there, like, because it was so nerve-wracking. As the vote came close, it was like, oh, yeah. But it worked out good.
Fantastic news. All right. What are we going to do in Lua? Oh, it says security medium. It doesn't start with security light.
Yeah, but it says, AKA, why there is no need to set your hair on fire.
Okay, good.
I've noticed a sort of a pattern in the security mediums that actually they're serving a new role. They're serving the role of telling you not to panic, which I think is important.
Okay, so security light is here's something that went wrong and what you can do to fix it. Security medium is here's some stuff that everybody's going to tell you that the world is coming to an end, but it's not really.
Yeah, so this
and then I just don't let you tell us about the other stuff.
Well, it's possible that in the future I may have to do one where I'm saying, look, you need to be careful here because there's this bad thing happening. But at the moment, the media tend to make things that are a little bit bad seem catastrophic.
Yeah.
And I think we should sort of counter that with a bit of sanity. Because that way, when something bad happens, you'll believe me.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. All right, so what's
the first one
meeting?
I want to nip on the head because it made me very cranky is the whole brouhaha over the Apple Watch. It's just, the place went nuts because there's no activation lock on the watch. There's no activation lock on a Rolex. There's no activation lock on any other watch on the planet. So the fact that Apple isn't doing something above and beyond what everyone else is doing is somehow, some way, a scandal. And what really gets me is that the actual news, if you were to apply logic to the situation, is that if you forget your passcode, the only thing you can do is blank the watch and therefore clear your data. So in other words, your data is protected, which surely to goodness is very important.
Right, right. Well, there's not really much data on the device.
No, but that I imagine that's going to change over the life of the iWatch.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to start to contain more. Sorry, Apple Watch.
So hard not to say that.
It's such a long, cumbersome name.
Yeah.
And that's without going into the whole edition and sport and the Apple Watch, Apple Watch, and the Apple Watch Sport. And the the one thing I will say, a secondary story that caused some kerfuffle is the fact that, so with Apple Pay, if the watch loses contact with your skin, it locks and then you can't do Apple Pay. But obviously, if you rotate your watch in your arm or something, it might lose contact for a very short time and you don't want your watch locking. So Apple went with a 1 second timeout. So if the watch loses contact with the skin for more than a second, it will lock. And apparently, if you're really quick as a thief, you can get it off and get your finger underneath it onto the sensor, and then you can keep it activated and go use people's credit cards. If you're very nimble-fingered.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to really lose sleep about that. I did want to say one other thing, though. The Mac Observer, John Martellaro, sorry about that, John, posted that the update 1.0.1 for the watch actually is a security update. So there's several things that you should go ahead and run that update. It's not intuitive how to do it because you got to start from the phone and then the phone has to talk to the watch, but the watch has to be on a charger and has to be more than 50% charged. So, you know, it's a little tedious, but you should do it.
Okay, remember what I said on Let's Talk Apple? Look at the watch as a removable part of the iPhone, and then all these processes make sense.
Yeah, but it's still got a lot more restrictions. Like, why can't I update it if it's got more than 50% charge when it's not on the charger? Or if it is on the charger, why does it have to be more than 50%? You know, it's just a bunch of...
I think they're very, very... Well, the risk is that you brick it.
Yeah, okay, all right, fine.
You know, it's a new device. They're definitely going to be careful about it because just imagine the news if they brick people's watches.
Yeah, that would probably not be so good.
It would not. So the one takeaway from all of this is that if someone steals your Apple Watch, you should use the app on the phone to cancel your credit cards. Just in case they were supremely nimble-fingered and got it off you within a second.
Okay.
Small takeaway. The other one then that completely and utterly threw the world for a loop was Venom, which had a cool icon with a big snake. Very, very scary. And there were breathless reports comparing it to Heartbleed and stuff. And that is literally crying wolf. That is just utterly unrealistic. So what this is a bug in a virtualization library, an open source virtualization library called QEMU or QEMU, or you'll hear lots of different pronunciations, but it's basically QEMU. The EMU is for emulation. So that's how I think you're supposed to say it is QEMU. And within QEMU, there is a virtual driver for a virtual floppy disk controller. And QEMU is used by a whole bunch of virtualization products, including Xen, KVM, Red Hat Enterprise Virtualization, and VirtualBox. And so this virtual floppy disk driver is part of QEMU, and even if you don't have a virtual floppy drive attached to your VM, the driver is still loaded, so the vulnerability which is in that code is still executable. Now, what this allows people to do is if you have root access on a VM, you can break out of the VM and go into what's called the hypervisor. In other words, the software that's controlling all the VMs. And once you're in the hypervisor, you can then nip into the other VMs. And so effectively, it's sort of like the blue pill. It allows you to break out of the VM. This is not good, right? But it's not catastrophic because this only affects certain types of situations. So if you have VirtualBox at home, this would allow you to hack yourself. But that's not really much of a danger. So for home users...
I hate it when I do that, though. God, why did you hack yourself again?
So for home users, not much going on here. And if you take the very other end of the scale, so if you have corporations with their own data centers, yes, they're using virtualization tools almost certainly. But again, they could only use it to hack themselves. So where you do have a problem is in the middle. So people like myself and yourself who rent server space somewhere, there's a high probability, like I rent a virtual machine. So in my case, I know I am potentially affected by this because my VM has to be a VM. You're on a sort of a halfway between dedicated and not dedicated server. I would guess you're on a VM, but I can't prove it. Mm-hmm. And there's a, you know, there's a lot of sort of middle of the road people who will have VMs. But the thing is, there is a patch out. And so we're all using large, well, we should all be using large reputable providers. So that patch is going to be applied. And as we speak, there are no in the wild attacks. So the patch is out. There aren't any attacks yet. I think the window of opportunity is, if not closed, then closing. Rapidly.
Okay.
So I don't think this is a crisis. And I think that calling it the next Heartbleed is utterly, utterly wrong.
I got to say, my favorite thing about this is Leo Laporte just got two new kittens and he named one of them Venom and the other one Heartbleed.
No.
Because later that's going to turn out really funny if one of the cats is mean and the other one is a sweetheart.
It
as
is.
As long as they pick the correct names.
And if he gets another cat, he can call it Logjam, which is the other named vulnerability we got this week, because that's now the fashion. If you name them, they get media attention. And if you don't name them, even if they're more serious, you don't.
Okay.
So Logjam is a pun on a logarithm, which is not something you hear very often. So basically, this involves something called Diffie-Hellman Key Exchange, which is quite old, but is very powerful. And unfortunately, this is another one of those times where I say that Bill Clinton got some stuff badly wrong. And I don't mean what he did in his office. I mean the U.S. export rules on cryptography during his tenure in the White House. So the policy, just to remind you, and if this sounds like a bit of deja vu, it's because it's only a few weeks ago that we had another export cipher that was found to be very, very compromised. And that's actually good news, because an awful lot of people protected themselves by protecting from this bug, by protecting themselves from the last bug. So there is a version of Diffie-Hellman for export. It was designed to be just about crackable in 1995. So what do you think it is today? Right?
Maybe very crackable. More crackable?
So what the researchers found is a way to sort of interject themselves into a Diffie-Hellman negotiation, and assuming the server is prepared to downgrade, the client will think they're talking strong Diffie-Hellman, but they're actually talking weak Diffie-Hellman. So they're sort of jamming the logarithms, hence the logjam is the name. And the fix is very straightforward. Servers should disable support for the old export ciphers. So the export version of Diffie-Hellman should just go away. And on an awful lot of servers, it went away last month because there was another export cipher causing trouble. And the advice then was take all export ciphers off, not just the one that was broken last month. And so as a sysadmin, I had a really quite a pleasant day going, oh, I did most of this last month. So that was nice. Now, the slightly annoying part is that the research actually had two findings. So the first finding was kind of stating the obvious. The really old export cipher is terrible. Okay, great, we kind of expected that. What we didn't expect them to say was that, oh yeah, on the version of Diffie-Hellman that is in use today, it's not as secure as you think. And what they're saying is that 124-bit Diffie-Hellman, which is now the standard, so 512 was the export cipher, which is utterly too weak, but 1024 bits is what we're using as standard today. And they think that's secure enough against individuals and secure enough against corporations, but probably not secure enough anymore against nation-state actors, be that Chinese, Russians, Americans, whoever. So if you have the resources of a nation-state, you can probably break 1024-bit Diffie-Hellman. So as a result, the paper's advice is twofold. One, get rid of export. Two, upgrade from 1024 to 2048-bit Diffie-Hellman. And that last bit actually involves some work by sysadmins. So a lot of sysadmins spent time this week upgrading their Diffie-Hellman, and that involves generating a new key, which can take 10, 15 minutes as it tries to find the big enough random key.
Ooh, for each server?
For each server, yes.
Ooh.
Yeah, but it's something you do, well, ideally you should probably do it every month, but no one's going to do that, but you should do it at least once. And the slight fly in the ointment is that older versions of Apache, so Apache 2.2 and back, cannot do 2048-bit Diffie-Hellman. So some people have to actually upgrade their server, not just their key.
How old is Apache 2.2? It's pretty old?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty old. But the problem is that people like Red Hat believe in, you know, basically they believe that the older something is, the longer it's had to have the bugs beaten out of it, the more secure it is, which is generally true. But it does mean you sometimes have obsolete software still in use. Yeah. So some people have more work to do than others. But remember, there's no need to panic. because 1024-bit is fine against everyone but nation states. So yes, we should all go to 2048 slowly, but it's not set your hair on fire time. And to help everyone get there, the wonderful SSL test at ssllabs.com is limiting everyone who has 1024-bit Diffie-Hellman to a B grade. So if you're worried about your bank, stick them into that tester. If they come back with an A, they're fine. So there we go, fire extinguishing done. Okay, you know, there is news here, but they are not like they were portrayed. They're not that big of a deal.
By the way, when you make your list of countries that you talk about being nation states, you do have to include Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, because they're part of the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance that has been have actually been attacking third-party browser support on smartphones on purpose. So yes, stop pointing the finger at me.
No, I did. I actually put what? Americans last, you'll notice.
I know you did, but try to find a country that isn't doing it, you know.
I think the Irish aren't.
Yeah, so you think.
We don't have the resources. I know we're not up to that, trust me.
Okay, so if you're broke, maybe you're not evil, but if you had the money, you would be.
It's not a matter of morals. Okay. It's a matter of means.
Okay.
So, moving on to Security Lite. Patch Tuesday has been and gone. Flash, Acrobat, Reader, Air, all updated from Adobe. Silverlight, .NET, Office, Windows, all updated from Microsoft. So, patchy, patchy, patch, patch.
Patch everything. Patch your watch.
You've already mentioned, so I don't have to say it again, the Apple Watch got an update. It is a security update as well as a bug fix update, which I guess are sort of the same thing.
By the way, I was really excited about that update because I haven't been getting credit for standing. I can be standing next to Steve doing the same thing, doing dishes while he's cooking or something like that, and he'll get stand credit and I won't. And I was so excited because I got the new update, and all of a sudden I was getting credit all day long. I went to bed with 15 hours of the 12 it wants you to do, and now it's stopped doing it again. I got up before 6, and I was like, oh, I'll put the watch on right away so that I can get the credit, and I didn't get credit for it. I might as well slept in.
Oh, that's annoying.
I only have 2 hours of credit, and I've been up since 10 to 6. I have two credit
stands. Don't believe that. Yeah, there's something wrong there. You're definitely standing more than that.
Yeah. Well, it makes me mad because it's something I know I'm bad at, so I want to improve. But if I'm not getting the metrics, then it's not going to help me. Just making me mad.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they do fix it in 1.0.2. Also to say, Mozilla patched Firefox and Thunderbird. So, important security news. This is a sort of a bad news thing, but it's just about made into light because there is something you can do. So security researchers did the very sensible thing of testing whether or not an Android factory reset actually scrubs your data. Because we tell everyone, if you're going to sell your phone, factory reset it and then sell it. But we're sort of taking it on trust that that is actually removing your data. So the researchers didn't take it on trust. They took hundreds of devices from lots of manufacturers, lots of versions of Android, and basically almost none of them do it properly. So they estimate about 500 million phones do not properly delete themselves when you do a factory reset. And why is this? How can you protect yourself? Encrypt your phone. The problem goes away.
I think you might have a typo in the show notes. It looks like it says private data is being properly deleted.
Oh, well, no, it's the exact opposite, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, that needs fixing.
I will go stick a knot in while you keep going.
Excellent, thank you. You know the way I said that security stuff tends to come in waves? Well, the wave against home routers is not over, not even nearly. So D-Link, Netgear, TP-Link, TrendNet, and Zeissel, not Apple, before you ask, are affected by a flaw in a Linux driver called NetUSB. And this is a buffer overflow, so basically takeover of router. There is a list in the show notes which to an advisory from the security researchers. It lists lots of different makes and models. My advice is basically twofold. You need to start treating, you know, if you have an old router that isn't getting updates anymore from the vendor, bin it. You can't rely on obsolete routers anymore. You need to have a modern, up-to-date router. And secondly, you should set an alarm in your calendar that once a month you log into your router's web interface so that it can tell you it has an update. And then do it. Because if you never log in, you'll never know. And there are so many attacks against home routers now, it's just not funny. And to prove the point, another story doing the rounds is that there is a large self-sustaining botnet that is simply living in home office, or home and small office routers, Soho routers. So this is real. This is not just fictitious. This is happening for real. So take care of your router.
Okay.
And so far, hear me knocking on wood, the Apple routers have been surprisingly robust at all of this carry-on.
By the way, I sent you a little note that people in Australia cringe every time you say router.
You did, but there are so many words that have a double that can be used in a double entendre. I'm going to continue to say head and stuff, even if it has second meanings. I just...
Well, but then does that mean I get to say fanny pack?
Everybody
yells at me every time I say fanny pack.
I don't yell at you, I titter.
No. Well, okay, then Australia, you are cleared to titter at Bart every time he says, and that's probably a bad word too. So keep going.
It's a perfectly normal word, it's just we happen to have abbreviated something else. Anyway, moving on. Keep an eye out for a security update for OS X's Safari and for iOS. No update as when we record, but there is an annoying bug that makes it possible to have the address bar in Safari lie to you. And this is obviously a danger for phishing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible for a website to put up the wrong address. So you think you're at somewhere you trust, but you're not. And of course, that's phishing territory. But again, they can't fake the SSL cert. So look out for that SSL cert.
Okay.
Something else I think is worth mentioning, a federal district judge had a very interesting ruling. So at the there's sort of a bit of a controversy about how customs treat people's electronic devices at quote-unquote ports of entry into the United States. And the government have been relying on sort of the law, of course, predates computers, right? That's so much of the problem in the modern world is that the laws predate computers. So the law says that they're allowed to take containers, which was written in a time of handbags and luggage. And the government have interpreted that as being, well, a computer is just a container, therefore we can confiscate them and we can do what we want with them. And a judge has said, actually, no. And I will quote exactly, one cannot treat an electronic storage device like a handbag simply because you can put things in it and carry it onto a plane. So I just thought it was wonderful to hear a judge say the bloody obvious. If right. you'd like to learn more, it is obviously a bit of an obscure legal point, but it actually is a sort of a civil rights issue in the States, so I thought it was worth mentioning.
Yeah. And I mean, is my ear a container? I'd stick stuff in my ear, my nose.
Exactly. They have a read of the link in the show notes for more detail.
Okay.
Notable breaches, not going to spend much time on these. They're all linked in the show notes if they may affect you. A kind of a scary one in terms of, this is really personal information. Adult Friend Finder leaked 4 million people's details, including email addresses and sexual orientations.
Oh,
that could be troublesome.
Yeah.
Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is apparently all the name of a company. Mm. They really went for a concise there. Have lost 1.1 million customer records, which kind of pales into insignificance compared to some of the other American insurers.
Anthem
who've
Blue
had
Cross.
Breaches. Yeah.
So basically, both of them. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So if that affects you, there are details in the show notes. Spyware maker MSpy may have suffered a breach, which could be quite bad since they have lots of data they probably shouldn't if you're sort of looking at things morally. They deny it, though. They say they're the victim of someone trying to make them look bad. I say link in the show notes. And Verizon had a bit of a boo-boo on their home routers, exposing 9 million people's details by mistake. That bug is fixed on Verizon, so your details were exposed but are not. Hmm. Links in the show notes. Again, suggested reading, just going to mention them. Kind of stating the obvious, but Google have some science to go behind our intuition. I have always said that security questions are dangerous, and my advice is to lie like a dog. Record your lies in a password manager and carry on with your life. Google basically have some scientific data to prove that fact. Link in the show notes.
I wanted to make one comment on that. We talked about this on the Daily Tech News show, and there is an interesting twist to this is as Tom pointed out, for people like us, a lot about us is out on the internet, right? I mean, people
right.
know, Bart, where you live. They know your friends' names. They know, you know, a lot of things about your history
yeah.
and a lot about me. He said, but this also affects normal people who haven't shared a lot of information. One of the examples Google gave was if somebody's location is in Korea then their city is probably where they were born. It might be Seoul. And it turns out it's like 60% of the people who live there were born in Seoul. And so you've got a really good chance of figuring stuff out about people without knowing anything about them other than something as simple as, you know, what, where's their IP address coming from.
And to really underscore that point, there was an incident during an American presidential election, two elections ago now. Well, depending on whether you count this one as being started already. Anyway, Sarah Palin was running for vice president, and someone hacked into her email. And how do they do that? They guessed that she might have gone to Wasilla High.
That's all it took.
Quite, you know, right? So it was Yahoo security questions. The question was, what was your high school? She put in the truth, and it cost her her email address.
Wow.
So lie like a dog. Record your lies and carry on. More NSA shenanigans. Apparently they were attacking app stores. I think you mentioned this obliquely as we were talking.
Yeah.
Not the Apple App Store, though, so that's good. Details in show notes. The Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, have released their report for 2014. The takeaway is that crime on social media is on the rise, so be careful. Lenovo used their system update software to patch a privilege escalation bug in their system update software, which I just like because it's sort of circular and fun. And there's a whole bunch more stuff in there that I'm not even going to draw attention to because you need to go eat soon.
Okay. We don't give bumps rush. We just want to make sure we have time for the fun stuff.
Right.
All right, what
exactly
are we doing, Bart?
Okay, so I have been spending quite a lot of time the last while reworking the code that drives xkpasswd.net. Mm-hmm. So the website is a free interface for people to play around with, the, you know, to generate passwords, but the brains behind that site are an open source library written in Perl that I have maintained and have released as free and open source since the beginning.
For new listeners, tell them what xkpasswd.net is.
It is a secure, memorable password generator, is what I've decided to christen it. The idea being that you have passwords that are long and secure and yet human-friendly, so that you can actually type them in and remember them if you need to.
Love now, it. It took me a long time to start using it, Bart, but I'm addicted to it. I get really mad when I look and I realize I let one of my password manager choose my password, and I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, because I don't enter my own passwords very often because I use a password manager. But as soon as I'm on a foreign machine, I have it on my iPhone and then I have to look and type. And I am always happy when it's an xkpasswd password and not pure random garbage because they are typable by right human beings. So I've been working for quite a while to fix some problems. And actually, since this is the NosillaCast, we'll give the problems to be solved. Sort of. So I have done a complete redesign of the code to solve three basic problems. So the first one is that the module was always distributed in a sort of an ad hoc way because it was just one file and it was just, I just put it on GitHub and people could download it. But that's not the Perl way of doing things. Perl uses something called CPAN, which is the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network, I believe, which is basically like a repository of all the officially of all the packages people have written. So you would say CPAN install whatever.
Okay.
And people just kept on sending me messages going, yeah, I want to use this code, it's cool, but why do I have to use
CPAN?
Why do I have to use this abnormal method of getting the code? There is a normal way. Why aren't you doing that? So okay, there was some prep work needed to make that possible. The module also had a somewhat of an inbuilt bias because I grew up in an English speaking country. And the module did not have support for accented characters, which rules out French and German and Spanish and Portuguese and lots of languages. So that meant full Unicode support end to end. You can't do that in a sort of a halfway house on that. Otherwise you end up with square boxes and all sorts of stupid things. So if you're going to do Unicode support, it's got to be ground up, do Unicode support. So that was.
Does that mean you'll support emojis in your passwords now?
Yes, absolutely. If you wanted, any Unicode character is acceptable. So if you wanted to use like poopy, steaming poopy piles as a separator between words, by all means, you can now do so with this code.
Thank goodness, because I was really missing the steaming poopy code in there.
And the other problem I set out to solve was one, actually, I believe it was one of our listeners who put the idea into my head. I believe it was Stephen Getz. He basically said, so I can go to xkpasswd.net and you have a lovely web interface there where I can expand all the different options and tweak all the settings. And then there's a button that hit says save and it spits out the configuration for that type of password in text. There's no way to put that into your code on the back end. he was right, there wasn't. I had sort of written my own to do that when I was running the website. It wasn't part of the standard code. Now it is. So the idea is that you can write, you can use the web interface to generate, you know, to generate the config you like, and then copy and paste that into a script that you can then use on your Mac.
So we should refer back to the a lesson a while back that you taught me, where we you're able to create like a service, for example, that will create a password. But the one the one I have, for example, I don't know, it's like 168 characters and insists you have a goat in it or something. So I've been wanting one that's a little simpler, but I can't remember how to do it. But this would help me, I guess.
This absolutely will help you. Yes.
Good.
So the idea is now you make it the way you want it on the website. You go to that save load tab and then you copy and paste the glop, and you can now import that glop into the library and make it do those kind of passwords.
Cool.
So there is a lot more detail in the first link in the show notes of all of the sort of the nitty gritty level, but really most of it I don't want to talk about. But one thing I do want to talk about. So the name has changed. It's gone from being xkpasswd.pm. So in other words, xkpasswd Perl module.
Yeah.
To being crypt:HS xkpasswd.
I'm not going to say all that. Do I have to say that out loud every time I talk about your website?
No, no. Well, the website isn't changing, right? The website is a web front end that's staying put, but the code is changing. And the reason it's changing is twofold. So first of all, CPAN, if you sign up as a developer on CPAN, they give you, I wouldn't call it a lecture. You know the way with the first time you use sudo, it offers you some words of wisdom, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. When you sign up to become a contributor to CPAN, they kind of give you a little talk. It's all in text, obviously. They don't actually talk to you, but it sort of says things like, respect the namespace. Ooh. So in other words, what they would like you to do is to be a good citizen of CPAN. And it's generally considered really bad manners to take something at the top level of the namespace unless you have something really worthy of the top level of the namespace. And so instead, what they would like you to do is sort of two things. First of all, be sure to differentiate your module from all the other modules that are out there. And secondly, give it a logical, sensible name that makes sense, that sits well in the namespace and that is obvious to people what it does. And so that's where the crypt:... comes from. So in other words, we're not at the root of the namespace. We're one level up. We're putting ourselves in the crypt package.
Crypt has other people's stuff in it.
Crypt has acres of stuff.
Okay.
So it's, yeah. So crypt, look at them like folders. So basically, I have moved it into the crypt folder. Now, the HSXKPasswd is for the second half of that lecture. If your module is similar to others, make clear why it's different. So there is a module called crypt:xkcdpassword, which at first blush might be exactly like my code. But actually, it's not. And the reason is because although I sort of hung myself, I sort of used XKCD as a hook to get people interested, my passwords are not like correct horse battery staple. They're more than that. Because actually, my module is inspired by two equally important things. It's inspired by Password Haystacks from Steve Gibson and correct horse battery staple. And so, the old name did not reflect that reality. So that's where the HS came from.
Oh, okay. Wait, HS is not Password Haystacks. Oh, Haystacks. Okay.
So it's Haystacks and XKCD password.
Okay.
Look, I could not make a... I couldn't have XKPasswd sitting next to XKCD password in crypt. That would just look terrible.
Have you chatted with that developer to say we should compare notes sometime or anything?
Well, no, because what he's providing is what the name suggests. Passwords exactly like correct horse battery staple, and that's a perfectly valid thing to provide. I just want to do something more. Okay. So the way I look at it is that I use the words as like, I was going to say scaffolding, but no, something that stays up, like the trusses and the girders of the password, and then adorn that with some symbols and some digits so that you have a broad coverage of characters, a long password, and yet still a human-friendly password. So that's why the name really did have to change.
Okay.
Okay, so with all that said, if you want to read more, you can. But really, we're going to skip on to the second link in the show notes, which is sort of a brief guide to just using the bloody thing.
Oh, good, good, good.
So what we're going to do is we're going to start by installing it. And because this code has been written with the intention of being distributed on CPAN, it now does things in the standard Perl way, which if you're a Perl developer is great, but if you're not, we're going to walk you through it anyway. Okay. So every time you install something from CPAN, what's actually happening automatically is exactly what we're going to do manually today. So because the code is in beta, I haven't put it in CPAN yet because it's also bad form to ship unfinished code in CPAN. So again, I paid attention to my little lecture. So we're going to install it manually. So the first thing to do is to go to the GitHub page for the project, which is GitHub.
I don't know where we are in the show notes to do that.
Okay, so it's in here somewhere. The first link in the show notes, at the very top of it is a gigantic big button saying download. So that'll take you to the GitHub page for the project. And you will see that there's a bunch of releases, and the top one is a pre-release version called crypt-hsxkpassability version 3.1.1 beta 1. Whole bunch of text, and if you scroll down under downloads, there's a file called crypt-hsxkpassability 3.1_01.tar.tc.
Well, stop! Nowhere near caught up. I'm just hearing noise, and all I've hit is project's GitHub page is where I am.
Okay, so you see the giant thing, download beta of via GitHub with a big star around it.
I see a star with 39 next to it.
Okay, so on the first of the two links in the show notes, and not the second one.
As I write this post, the module is not on CPAN. It's CPAN yet. The module could be downloaded
you're on the second. Okay, you can click that link either.
The first link. You might have a different save version. Maybe you've been editing it. Okay,
no. There's two links in the show notes. I'm still on the first one. You've moved on to the second one.
That's what you think. I'm looking at the first one. Anyway, project's GitHub page. So I'm at the project's. I'm at bbushot/xkpasswd.pm.
/ releases? Nope. So click on the button that says releases.
Okay. Looks like it's selected, but yeah. That's where I am.
Okay,
so the pre-release on the left.
The pre-release on the left. Scroll down to the bottom there where there's three downloads, and one of them is a tar.gz file that's 19.7 megabytes big.
Yes, I see that.
Download that file. Okay, so once that's downloaded, and it really doesn't matter where you save it, we're going to delete it all when we're finished. Just double-click it. It should expand into a folder. Yes.
And it did.
And then open a terminal window and go into that folder. So CD into that folder. And I like to go CD space and then drag and drop from the finder into the terminal.
I'm just all over the terminal now because I've been taming it. So that worked for me.
Okay. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to use Perl to create an installer.
Okay.
And the reason for this is because people could do this on Windows. They could do it on a Mac. So basically Perl is going to build the installer for the system it's running on. And then we're going to use that installer to install it. So to build the installer, you type Perl. Mm-hmm. Space build with a capital B UILD dot PL with a capital P and a capital L.
Okay.
It is probably going to tell you that you're missing one or more requirements. That's normal. Don't panic.
Yeah, UniDecode is not installed.
Oh,
error warnings found in prerequisite. Okay.
Good. I'm expecting that to happen.
All right.
It didn't happen on my system because I have my prerequisites, but you probably don't. Now, if we were using CPAN, it would have gone and fetched all those prerequisites automatically, which is why CPAN rocks.
Okay.
But we don't have much work to do because we can actually, this new installer we've just created, so there should now be a file called build with a capital B and no file extension.
That's correct, there is.
And that is this installer we've created especially for our system. So we say .slash build space install deps as all one word.
Deps, D-E-P-S?
Yeah. In other words, install dependencies is what that means.
Okay.
And so it's then going to go off and fetch whatever it was missing.
Checking optional dependencies. Install email.
Good. Okay, so it's going to automatically install the stuff that's not optional, but it's now letting you choose the optional stuff. So I actually wanted to talk about this. So the only optionals I would recommend you install are JSON or JSON.
Uh-huh.
And one called math:// either random secure or secure random. I can't remember which way around that is.
Okay, so I'm going to say no to email.
No to email.
Okay. Random secure, yes.
Random secure, yes.
Mozilla, no.
No.
Entropy algorithms, no.
No.
JSON, yes.
Yes.
This is fun. Database was generated, fetching with LWP. It's
okay, now you're going to watch to glop O extreme.
Good glop. Oh, it's going to the internet. It's going to CPAN. It's drawing dots on screen.
It's compiling stuff. Oh, that reminds me. Don't have the OS X command line tools installed, you should.
Should have done that before this, or I will now?
I know you have it done.
No, I know, but what about everybody else?
Everyone else should have done it before now. I meant to say that up front.
Okay.
There will be a link in the show notes saying how to do that.
Okay,
you could do it by installing the whole of Xcode, but don't do that.
Oh, so the only reason I have it installed is because of the work we did with the VPN with Donald Burr.
Yes.
Right.
Indeed, that would have required the tools. Okay, is that still glopping away? Or
it just finished glopping. Bakehead return bad status install seems impossible.
Ooh, that's not good glopping.
Are we sure? You know what? I rebuilt this machine from scratch. Do we know I have the command line tools?
Oh, ah, well, we can find out. Okay,
oh, it also says agreeing to the Xcode iOS license requires admin privileges. Please rerun as root via sudo.
Okay, that means the tools are either half installed or not installed.
/user/bin/make not okay. Can't test without successful make. Danger, danger, Will Robinson.
Okay, so you're missing half of the bits and bobs to do terminally stuff. That's okay. Okay, so there's a section in italics there saying, note, Mac users install the command line developer tools before attempting. And there's a link to a lovely article on OS X Daily that lets you do it without installing Xcode.
Okay, so we're going to do that live while the audience waits? Is this going to
be hit pause on that.
Okay, I'm going to... How do you pause? How do you pause out of your hijack? Let me find the pause button. Let's see. Don't let me forget to unpause. Okay, there we go. Pause recording. Holding. Hold, please. And I think we're back. Yes, it looks like we're back, and Allison has installed the command line tool. So do
okay.
I just...
So it should be... And I'm not actually sure if I said sudo last time. Did I say sudo last time?
Nope, so well, there I should this time. Okay.
Yeah, so you would have been broken twice. So
okay,
sudo...
So xcode dash...
No, sudo /build install deps.
Okay, hang on. I pulled the wrong thing. Let me do this. Okay, so it's... I want... sudo /build install deps. Okay. And authenticated, checking. Okay, I don't want no to Mozilla, yes to JSON. Oh, it's in different order. That's weird. Not no to mail, math random, yes. Entropy algorithms, no?
No.
Okay. Yes. Installing and glopping. All right, we're re-glopping. This is good audio, I bet, huh? At least we paused twice.
We might want to pause again.
Well, no, that didn't take too long. So,
was it finished?
No. It's still going. But one thing you said, I want to make sure I understood. When you said that it's building an installer, it's building an installer that's particular to my type of operating system, right? If
yes.
I were sitting on Windows, it would be doing something different than what it's doing to me on the Mac.
It would make the file called build. But that file would have different content. That would be a Windows builder instead of a Mac builder. Or if you're on Linux, it would be a Linuxy one. So it's basically, it's looking at the version of Perl installed in your computer, where Perl keeps stuff on your computer. It's basically looking at your computer to see how its Perl hangs together and writing an installer that is aware of your computer.
Okay. So now it just asked me to agree to the license agreement.
That sounds good.
For the Mac developer program? Ooh, now it's glopping some more. Look at it go. Oh, yeah, this is a different type of glop.
It's a lot of OKs
flying by, so that's good.
It's basically compiling code and stuff, which is why you need the developer tools.
Okay.
And if you were using CPAN, you would see the same glop, but you have gotten there by going CPAN and the name of the module, and it would have done it all in one go.
Oh, okay. That's not too bad, though. All right, so while this continues to glop on, talk to me about what it is we're going to be doing next.
Okay, so when that's done, we're going to just call the installer with no arguments, so just /build. And what that's going to do is it's going to assemble like a staged version of the module. So it's going to do an install, but not to the real place. It's going to assemble everything together. And then we're going to do a build test, which you don't have to. It's optional, but it's a good idea, which will test that the module is working on your system. And then we're going to do sudo build install, which does what it says on the tin.
I didn't follow much of that, but I'm ready.
Okay, well, we'll do it again. We'll go through it slowly. So is it done glopping?
Okay, it's done glopping.
Okay,
and
you now have
everything
all the
says okay.
Okay, so now just say /build with nothing else after it or before it.
Okay. And
it
that's
should say building,
building
crypt HSXA password WD should take 10
What does
seconds.
It mean to build?
So it is now taking. So if you look in that folder, it has folders like lib and share and txt or t and stuff. So it's taking all of the parts that make up the module and assembling them in the correct way in a new folder it would have created called _build.
What's a module?
A collection of Perl code distributed over lots of different files.
Okay. All right. So build worked.
Build built. And we can now optionally, just to satisfy ourselves that it worked, we can say .build/test. Not very exciting. Results should be pass.
Skipped author test not required for installation. Results pass.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not a very interesting test suite. But anyway, so now we can do the big thing.
All right.
So we can now actually install it into our system by saying sudo space .build/install.
Capital or lowercase?
So the build is always a capital and all the rest is lowercase.
Okay, even though I see a thing called install with all capital letters, I'm going to type it lowercase.
That is a text file that tells you how to do all this, actually.
Oh, okay. All right, it's building. It's done.
Yeah, so you should have seen it copy in...
installing a whole bunch of libraries. Okay, or a bunch of stuff in the library.
And then we'll have installed the last thing is a little man page as well. So if you installed it correctly, you can now use the Perl equivalent of man, which is Perl doc. So P-R-E-L doc space crypt :: HSXK pass.
Oh, I have to type it all out.
Only if you want to.
No, I
and you
to.
Should see
it won't
the
autofill for me.
Full. Oh, of course it won't. Sorry. You can copy paste from the show notes.
Oh, I got to type the whole. I got to keep going. I got to go -v3.1.
No, you don't. No, it's just Perl doc space crypt :HSXK pass WD.
Oh, there's a colon.
So Perl doc.
Put a dash in there.
Where? Not what?
Just a second. There we go. When I saw it, what was installed, it showed it with a dash.
Yeah, don't worry about that.
But it slowed me way down when I tried to type it.
My general advice is don't read what it says when you're installing Perl stuff.
Okay. All right, good. All right, so I've got a man page.
Perl doc now has... So there's all the full documentation should you want it.
Okay.
And the module is installed.
Okay.
So now here's a question for you. Do we split this in two or do we keep going?
Let's see. I have no idea how long we've been recording because we've stopped twice. Let's see. We've gone long enough probably. We're probably in good shape. It's really a teaser to stop right there, though.
We could keep recording, but not play it this week.
So just tease everybody else?
Yeah, but get it done.
Well, that's not a bad idea. Let me think. So how much longer is the next piece?
I'm not sure how quickly the typing is going to go. So okay. Between 15 and 30.
All right. Let's go ahead and stop it here. And we'll just leave that. Nobody will actually know until next week whether we say time travel or whether we kept going. They just won't know.
Ooh, it's a bizarre kind of teaser. Okay. So given the virtual pause, beep, or whatever we say.
No. You have to end the show.
Oh, okay. So until next time, happy computing.
All right, that was really, really mean of us, but we ended up going on quite a long time for the actual fun part of this where I got to experiment and use the modules. So it is a really good episode, but I feel guilty that we left you guys hanging right as we got into the good part. So we sort of did all the hard parts up front, and that's all you got to hear. By the way, I did cut a bunch of parts out where we got kind of lost and got scrambled, but I left in some of the comedy of when I couldn't quite figure out what he was saying to do. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Please head on over to clarify-it.com. Get your free copy of your trial of Clarify and be sure to tell them I sent you. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions. We did get a dumb question this week. I should probably read that out. I answered a dumb question, but I should probably put that in the show for next time. And send your comments and suggestions to me at allison@podfeet.com. Love to get emails from you guys. I'm probably pretty close to answer every single one. So head on over to allison@podfeet.com. Send me a message. You can follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Check out the NoSilicast Google Plus community, like we talked about. Gary Benny did this week. Got us over 500 people in there. It's not super chatty, so it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to go in there. So don't get worried that it's too chatty. It's just like the right amount of chatty. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, like Wannabe and John and Nth Mike did, I think Nth Mike, it was his second time here, but the other two had just come here for the first time. They came into the live show by going to podfeet.com/live. You can do that on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.